Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. And before I go any further, I want to extend my enormous thanks to all who pledged in support of Talking Animals on last Wednesday's Fun Drive show or beforehand. Special thanks go to Allison Giannato, a listener, supporter, and friend of Talking Animals from the very earliest days, who donated an amount exceeding my fundraising goal, an overwhelming gesture of kindness and generosity, which I greatly appreciate. So thank you, one and all. Meanwhile, my guest on today's show is Dr. Benita Bergen, who in 1975 invented the concept of the service dog to assist people with mobility limitations. It was at that point that Dr. Bergen founded Canine Companions for Independence, CCI, the first nonprofit organization to train and place service dogs. After she left CCI in 1991, Dr. Bergen founded what was then called the Assistance Dog Institute, formerly designated a university in early 2004. Now called the Bergen College of Canine Studies, it operates as a distinctive, accredited nonprofit institution dedicated entirely to the human-canine partnership. It offers associate, bachelor, and master's degrees in canine studies, focusing on training service dogs using positive, non-aversive methods. So with 50 years having now passed since Dr. Bergen formulated the realm of the service dog assisting folks with mobility issues, I'll ask her to survey this scene and chart key developments spanning those 5 decades when I speak with Dr. Benita Bergen here in just a moment on Talking Animals on WMNF. Coming up later in today's program, I'll play an extended comedy piece very much relevant to our discussion with Dr. Bergen about service dogs. It's by rising comedy star Josh Johnson, whom you may know, of course, from The Daily Show. That's coming up a bit later in today's program. Right now, though, let's get into our conversation with Dr. Bergen with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Dr. Benita Bergen to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Dr. Bergen.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
And thank you for the invitation.
For sure. So it's a pleasure, of course, to speak with you. It's a rare opportunity to talk with someone who's a true pioneer in whatever field they operate. So, of course, that's the realm of service dogs that we just touched on and that assist those with mobility issues. So this now represents 50 years of history. I hope to address some key developments spanning that period. But first, I'd love to sort of head back to the very beginning. Take me back 50-plus years. What were you doing and what was your involvement with dogs, such that you began to ponder how dogs could assist those with mobility issues?
Well, my husband and I went to Australia and taught for a couple years, and then we traveled, and I saw a lot of sights that I'd never seen in the United States with, you know, a disabled individual who was leaning on a donkey and had the donkey piled with pots and pans and unloaded them on a street corner in Kathmandu and, you know, sold them. And I think the most stunning sight I saw is from a rooftop restaurant in Ankara, Turkey, where there was I was sitting there right in front of me was the 6-lane freeway through the middle of Ankara. And I saw this man absolutely flat, lying flat on the sidewalk, but using his elbows to propel himself down the street. And of course I was just in awe, but there wasn't a single Turkish person noticing it or paying attention because it was not an uncommon sight. He actually went off the side of the sidewalk and continued using his elbows to go across the 6-lane freeway, which was,
goodness.
Just holding my breath. I know,
wow.
Because in Asia, they do not follow traffic stoplights in the same way we do. And then he actually made it across and then crawled away on the sidewalk on my side of the street.
Still crawling on his arms each part of the way.
Yeah, dragging his trunk and his legs behind him. I mean,
yeah.
It was an incredible sight. So when I came back to the United States and went into a master's program in early childhood education special ed, I didn't know anything about disabilities at all. But I really wanted to work with kids, teaching them. And so the fact that it was combined with a special ed program really wasn't my choice. It was just what was being offered. But I learned in the class that in this country, we put people with disabilities in state hospitals. So that was a shocking revelation to me. I had no idea.
At the time, Dr. Bergen, was that regardless of the disability, that just was sort of a sweeping, that's where they went as a result?
Understood it, it was pretty sweeping.
Wow.
I still don't know the details of it. I just know that in the class, the instructor finally turned to the students, and most of the students in the class knew about disabilities, worked in state hospitals. They were very familiar with the disability methodologies and community in the country. But he did ask the student population, and I was very shy. I mean, exceedingly shy. I said nothing. I had said nothing up to that point in the class at all. But he did ask what he thought, could help people with disabilities. And of course, the people that knew a lot were saying, well, we should put stainless steel on the walls in the institution so there's no bacterial or viral problems. Or we should just be, serving more nutritious meals. And I finally, had all of those images of disabilities that I saw in India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and in Turkey that were out and about. In one yeah. way or another, they were out and about. And I raised my hand, and I finally got up the nerve to say something, and I started my sentence by saying, well, when I was in Asia, I saw, and immediately two of the students screamed at me, yelled at me, literally, in a master's classroom. And of course, I was just totally devastated because I finally got the nerve to talk. But they said, don't you bring up Asia. In Asia, they let their disabled people die. And I was stunned. I was just stunned. But more than anything, I thought, these are the people that are working in institutions managing people with disabilities.
Wow.
If they're that controlling, that the life of those people with disabilities would not be very positive. And I thought, immediately, what could be done? How could we get these people with disabilities out of these institutions and away from these controlling attitudes? And I mean, this was really naive on my part to think everybody was like that, but it was just so shocking for me at that moment.
Well, they were at that point, if I understand the story correctly, the sequence, they were shouting you down before you had even introduced an idea. You were just sort of commenting on what you had seen. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I didn't have any ideas. I just was going to describe what I'd seen in other countries. I didn't even have an idea. But as I sat there, I thought, well, there's no way, what could I do? What could be done? Not actually what could I do. I was thinking what could be done. And I thought there's no way this in Santa Rosa, California, for example, donkeys and burros would be allowed to walk down the streets of town or, the people with disabilities allowed to crawl around. So I thought, what could change that? And I don't know why, and I can't answer this question, but I just said to myself, dogs. Mm. Dogs could do it. And I really didn't know what was needed. I really didn't know how they could help. All I just felt is that dogs could be that way of getting people out of institutions and able to do things for themselves.
It could be a more reasonable substitute, it sounds like, for the donkeys and burros that you've seen on your travels.
Yes, exactly.
Like, that's not going to work here in Santa Rosa or wherever we are, but a dog might. Were you already a big dog person at that point? Or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had dogs all my life. As a matter of fact, when I was 12, my mom took me down to a town by, 20 miles away to work with our dog in training. And they were using treats to train the dog. I was 12, so I didn't really, get into this in any level. But my husband and I, when we got married, got a dog. We just, the dogs have been our partners in our lives forever, but not in working roles.
Before you had that aha moment, it sounds like they hadn't really overlapped your working life. They hadn't intersected. Oh. You just always loved dogs growing up married.
Exactly. We took them everywhere with us. They slept on our beds with us, that kind of close relationships. But
you say them, it sounds like it's plural back then even. There was more than one dog?
Yes, that's true too.
Two, anyway, three, how many were we talking about back then?
Well, back then we had a border collie and a mixed breed, basically several different sporting dogs combined into this one dog. But the thing that was so amazing is when I would go, I went to people and tried to say, can this be done? Can you do it? You know, I was trying to get somebody to take the idea and run with it. And again, I didn't know exactly what would be needed, but I even went to Guide Dogs for the Blind down in San Rafael to see if they would pick it up. The message that I got from every single experienced dog trainer and dog training program was, it couldn't be done. Give it up.
Oh, really?
No way it could be done. And I realized now, many years later, that the reason that they were saying that is the dog training methods at that time were choke, chain, jerks, and aversive methods to control the dogs, not teaching methods, or, you know, even the treat training that I had learned when I was 12 wasn't being utilized. So
do you think that's why people were so dismissive of your then sort of just seedling of an idea?
Yeah, I'm sure.
They looked at the training and said, well, that's not going to work the way we normally train a dog. But that was kind of missing the point.
How could somebody with a disability basically do a choke, chain, jerk?
Yeah.
Right.
So how did you, sound like you, by that time you were starting to feel like I'm a woman on a mission of sorts. And so you weren't deterred by people saying no.
That's exactly correct. So what I did was I quit teaching and I went to work in a dog kennel for $2 an hour and tried to learn more about training dogs and working with dogs. And of course, I found while I was there, because it turned out to be a show dog kennel, I didn't even know the difference. They said it couldn't be done as well. So what I did was I finally heard about this program in Santa Rosa that was for disabled individuals. And I called to talk to the CEO to see if maybe they would be interested, the program, in trying to do something like this. And the receptionist wouldn't let me talk to the CEO. She said, no way, you have to tell me what the idea is, and then I can ask him if he'll take your call. So I described basically the outline of what I had in mind, because I didn't have any specifics at the time. And I described it to her, and suddenly she said, I'll do it. And I'm like, who are you? I mean, this was on a phone call, so I had no idea.
Right, who you're talking to. Yeah.
And how disabled she was. And again, my knowledge was still very limited about disabilities at that time. So we met. And I found out that she was so severely disabled. She was a quadriplegic, first of all, but she was so severely disabled that if her head fell forward, somebody had to come along and push it back up, because she didn't have enough strength in her neck muscles to lift her own head back up. So I knew, I thought, wow, this is going to be an interesting process. But the thing is, she wanted to do it, and she was determined. My heavens, it was just remarkable to see this woman who's soft spoken, let alone be able to physically do anything. I mean, she could barely hold anything with her hands.
Yeah.
And she wanted to do it, and it just happened that my husband and I had a litter of puppies. They were Golden Lab crosses. So we started, she and I. Her name was Carrie Canales, by the way, and she and I started to work with this puppy, and she named the puppy Abdul, which in Turkish means servant of God. Mm. I mean, she's very religious, but anyway, she and I started working with him, and I was using the methods I would use to teach a student in school, not a dog.
Yeah.
And it turned out to work beautifully. I mean, I did go back to trying some treats like I had when I was 12 years of age, but I'd show him what to do. He would try to do it. We'd give him a treat for trying. We just kept working with him. The thing I think that's so astounding is between Carrie and Abdul, it worked. And had that first opportunity not worked, who knows, would I have continued?
But yeah, well, this is the key thing about Carrie in the first part of this story is that, unlike everybody else he had presented the idea to, she responded with great enthusiasm. She thought you had a great idea.
Determination.
Yeah.
Oh, my heavens. I mean, determination when she had so little movement. So she would ask me things, and I was determined too. Don't get me wrong, but
well,
I
think we already know you were determined. You kept pitching your idea until finally somebody said, hey, I hear a good idea here.
Which, yeah, but I was also a little bit overzealous because she would ask me things like, she'd say things like, when her attendant, because she had 24-hour attendant care. Mm. I mean, there was no way she could do anything by herself at all.
Yeah.
And she said, well, when her attendant would go to shopping, she would have to just sit in her chair. And if it got dark and her attendant hadn't gotten back yet, you know, she'd be sitting in the dark. And she asked me, she said, can we train the dog to turn the light switch on? And wow. Here I am, like, full of, you know, drive. And I said, sure, yes, we can do that.
Without knowing for sure if it could be done, you just said,
I did,
we'll do it.
No idea of how to even do it.
Right.
She asked me things like, she would sit in her chair and with a jacket on or a sweater on, and she'd get overheated. She did not ever want to have to call her attendant for help.
Yeah. She didn't. She was looking for independence of whatever kind she could get, right? Yeah.
Well, that was exactly what I learned out of this, she wanted to be able to do things for herself or in partnership with a dog, but for herself. And the drive was so strong. And she wanted to have a way for her jacket to be taken off. She wanted to have a way to have the dog pick up the TV remote if she dropped it and give it back to her. And I'm saying, yes, 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 we can do all these things. And of course, I didn't have a clue, but we worked hard at it. And we tried different things. And the thing that was amazing was Abdul was so cooperative. He wanted to serve. He wanted to help her. He wanted to do what he could do. And what if it was a different breed of dog? What if it was a different, who knows?
This story is an amazing confluence of people and Abdul, the dog, that were totally geared up for this and just like determined and enthusiastic and again, undeterred by any sort of development. And the three of you, it sounds like that's why we have the story we have.
It's remarkable. I named the program after a lot of thought. I named it Canine. I learned, by the way, I knew nothing about nonprofit organizations at that time. So when I finally realized that there were other people coming to me wanting me to do this for them with a dog, I named it Canine Companions for Independence, because that's what Carrie wanted, just like you said. She wanted to be independent, and we did it. I mean, we got it so the dog would take off her jacket, the dog would turn the light switches on and off, on and off. The dog would open and shut doors. I mean, she was worried about living in a mobile home, that she was worried about it catching fire and being stuck there and not able to get out the door. She asked, can we train the dogs to open the door? Of course, I said, and we did it.
That sounds like that was your answer to every question.
But
you actually willed it to be true each time.
Yeah, well, and I used, again, how you would teach a child to do things. And that's how we got so far away from using aversive methods, because we taught him how to do it. We showed him how to do it. We used his brain, his capability, his drive to want to help. It was an amazing early experience, and it's continuing. I mean, we're still finding that dogs have that same desire to please and desire to be partners with humans.
We should remind people this is 50 odd years ago, the story you're describing. So what we've learned about dogs since,
that's
different. But you didn't have access to any of that information, because none of those studies books and stuff.
But I saw his mind.
Right.
I mean, I saw that he had a thinking, actually cognitive capability based on a mind that could work and plan and strategize. And I started to realize afterwards in life, well, if this is an animal that was out hunting, they would have a strategy. They would plan. They would, you know, you'd go out with a group of dogs wolves, and they would, one of them would get in front to get the neck of the dog, the deer, and pull them down. One would get behind to catch the legs. I mean, they planned and strategized.
Yeah.
And so to find that same ability in a dog, actually more because, of course, the dog was bred in our image as yeah. humans.
Well, so, I got a couple of follow-up questions for that, but just in case some people might have tuned in a bit late and want to know who they're listening to, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, who did just tune in. My guest is Dr. Benita Bergen, who in 1975 pioneered the concept of the service dog to assist people with mobility limitations. That's kind of what we're discussing right now, of course. She now runs Bergen College of Canine Studies, offering associate, bachelor, and master's degree in canine studies. If you'd like to ask Dr. Bergen a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So, Dr. Bergen, in those earliest days with Abdul and Carrie, sounds like everything you thought she asked, hey, could we teach him to do this? Can we teach him to do this? The answer, your immediate answer was yes. But was there ever anything that sort of didn't work the way you initially hoped or envisioned?
No. In all honesty, what she asked for, the dog was able to physically do for her.
So you just kept going, everything she raised, like, what about this possibility? What about that possibility? You could figure out how to teach Abdul to do it, and he could figure out how to do it.
That's right. And the only thing that someone later on asked for was for the dog to pull their wheelchair. Carrie couldn't do that. She didn't have the strength to hold on to the backpack and have the dog pull. But she had a power wheelchair, so she and the dog, I mean, and the thing is, the city of Santa Rosa let us take the dog into places, restaurants and malls and all kinds of places that dogs weren't allowed. And they never questioned it. They never argued with us. They never tried to find fault with this.
This is long before ADA stuff, probably, right?
No, not even then.
Right, no, but I mean that at this time initially, there probably was any legislation to address that. But people just were so impressed probably to see Abdul and Carrie working together like that they probably said, come right in, go ahead.
And they loved it. They loved seeing someone with a disability out and about and managing a dog. People would swarm over to talk to her and wanted to know more about it and wanted to pet Abdul. We had to do things like teach Abdul not to go toward them to get petted once he realized people wanted to pet him.
That
he'd sit by her side and wait until
him from the job at hand.
Yeah,
probably, right?
Yeah. Those were kind of interesting things to run into. But I think one of the dramatic things for me in terms of work, I mean, I learned obviously a lot about disabilities and more with every different disability that I placed a dog with. But what I found was they don't have a social life. A lot of people that are in wheelchairs do not have a social life, or they go out. I mean, that's different today, so don't,
right.
I'm talking about.
But back then, because they were housebound, probably much limited like Carrie was, I guess, right?
Yeah, and when she did go out, she would have to have an attendant with her. And someone would come up, even when she started to have Abdul, someone would come up and ask her, ask her attendant, does she, referring to Carrie, want this or want that? In other words,
as if she weren't a person in the conversation.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the more she went out with Abdul, the more people would ask her.
Wow.
What
a significant shift that is.
Yeah, because they realized that she was able to manage a dog. She must be capable.
She can answer your question and understand what you're saying, despite what you might have thought initially. Yeah.
Yeah, it was an amazing transformation, and it was amazing for me to realize how much more socially the dog has also added to her life capabilities. So it still is an exciting time, because we do a lot of research into dog cognition, and we're finding a lot more brain power than we thought was there
initially.
We're finding a lot more.
Well, we might come back to that, but I'm curious, like, how did you, once things are so successful and exhilarating with Carrie and Abdul, how did you kind of widen out from there? Who was the next person besides Carrie that you said, well, let's try these methods with another person, another dog, maybe?
Yeah, there was a gentleman who lived not in Santa Rosa, but a little bit out of town. The retrieve became the absolute, needed by everybody. It didn't matter what their disability was. They needed retrieve. So that and then it was what can and will the dog retrieve, and how much weight can the dog carry, and how can they give it back to the person. So we had to teach the dog, you don't just take it over and throw it in their lap. You have to actually put it in their hand. And those kinds of more definitive methods of what the dogs was required to do person by person kept coming up. But that particular person that I was mentioning was the one that wanted the dog to pull the wheelchair because they were in a manual chair, but they got tired and they couldn't go over the car. And could they put, you know, could they have the dog beside them and reach down and hold the backpack and have the dog pull? And that was another thing that we trained, which, again, didn't apply to carry but became a newer methodology. And it was great. It's so great to see. I mean, it was just this.
So that's in lieu, obviously, of electric chair, people that would just have to wheel it manually and to sort of give them a break or give them an opportunity to not wheel it at that moment. That dog in that situation pulls the chair.
Right.
Wow, that's great.
And all kinds of different light switches and, you know, going to a light, having to push the button to turn the lights on or to get into a mall or to go across the road. You know, they had to learn all of those things. They had to learn to use their paw to push buttons. They had to learn to use their nose to push other buttons. You know, and they could basically, once you gave them a couple opportunities to try different ways, then they started to make up their own minds about what worked the best. I mean, I'm still in awe of what dogs are capable of doing and how smart they are. And it doesn't stop. It doesn't stop. And the other thing that I learned, which was really probably one of the more dynamic things in this whole process, was that the early childhood education studies that I did in that master's, which were about like Piaget and his cohorts at that time and how kids reacted and saw things, a lot of that was applicable to raising dogs, to training dogs, and continues to be. I mean, Kohlberg's study about, you know, this, how you motivate and how motivation changes from one stage to another developmentally, totally applicable to dogs. I mean, there has not been a stopping point yet. We do not literally know how intelligent dogs are, because in order to figure out how intelligent dogs are, we have to be intelligent enough to set up methods to figure it out.
To assess the intelligence.
Yeah.
No bounds thus far. Yeah. No, that's great. And that's why I think when Carrie kept asking, well, can Abdul do this or that? The answer, you would say yes because of your training, but the dog was able to actually do it because he was Abdul. And Carrie kept sort of raising these challenges because she just was so frustrated by just being limited by an attendant. So again, it's just an amazing matching up of things that sounds like it's carried forth to this very day.
Oh, it's an amazing world. The world of, and we had to also learn about every different disability. You know, as I built a program and I hired instructors and stuff, I mean, we needed to know each different disability and their needs so that we could tailor the dog. And another big, big part of what was, we actually got into hiring. When I first got enough money to hire an instructor, I hired one of the, you know, really well-known instructors in Santa Rosa. And that instructor used diversive methods. They used a choke chain jerk and stuff like that. And it was interesting to me because, and not, you know, sad, but interesting, because what I found is the dogs that were trained with the aversive methods were returned. Never was a dog returned. Every time we placed a dog with someone, it wasn't returned. But we actually started seeing dogs coming back because the person with a disability couldn't use the aversive methods. And if you were taught by aversive methods, you expected to use aversive methods.
Was that because their strength or mobility or whatever was limited in such a way, or was it also like a philosophical thing, or they couldn't you know, they didn't feel okay using a choke chain or some other aversive method on that dog.
At that time, it was because they couldn't do it.
Yeah. They couldn't carry it out physically.
And even though the dog was fully trained, the fact that the dog realized that they couldn't and wouldn't be using these aversive methods, having been trained by aversive methods, the dog wanted out of there. The dog could leave the situation. Using aversive methods didn't train them or didn't teach them or didn't allow them to learn to have a loving partnership with the person.
Yeah.
Instead, it was, you have to do it. If you don't, I'm going to...
conflict built into that when that's the last thing there should be probably in that relationship.
Oh, my gosh. If I'm not clear on anything, I'm clear on that.
Yeah.
The amount of love and dedication and teaming capabilities and partnership capabilities dogs have is predicated on having that love thrive.
Yeah, well, it's just like what you were saying early on about Abdul. He kind of was a want to please kind of guy. And again, that's probably because he was a happy guy and well loved, well treated. And
we didn't use aversive methods.
Right, so a dog being treated a different way would have responded most likely a different way. So even if that happened to be the dog in the situation with Carrie, a lot of this maybe we wouldn't be discussing right now.
Right, that's absolute true.
Yeah.
And we saw it over and over and over. People still are using aversive methods to train. And when they come to our college, we emphasize the importance of building a loving relationship and partnership. And again, we're also talk about early childhood education, that first 14 weeks of the puppy's life, by the time we actually start teaching them to sit and down and do other commands at 3.5 weeks of age.
Wow.
Just like early childhood education. We teach them early. We teach them value systems early, so they have to wait before they get their meal. Nobody hits them to stop them. They just use the term wait. And then if they don't wait, they take the food away so that they don't get the food. And then they learn, the dog figures out.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get the food unless I sit here quietly. It's just a remarkable thing.
So, Dr. Bergen, it just sounds like you're continuing to just sort of have a sense of awe about dogs and what they're capable of. So now, 50 years later, from the time we were talking about with Carrie and Abdul, what are some more striking things that you've realized through research or through observational work or other things that dogs could do that you would have never imagined back when you were having these sort of breakthroughs with Carrie and Abdul?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one because she asked for the more complicated tasks because of her limitations.
So yeah.
We actually, most people don't need that level of skill out of a dog, although we train it anyway. We teach our students to how to teach every single command so that they know, if they do get a client like that. We do a lot of, I think the most recent epiphany that I've had, and it doesn't make any sense that I didn't have it before, but the fact that only in the last 10 years I kind of went, whoa, wait a minute here. Part of being disabled is not socializing with people, not having opportunities to go socialize. You just don't do it. Even today, there's much less of that way more than when Carrie was, when I started working with Carrie, but still. So we are now, and I just have to laugh because I think, how could I have been so stupid all those years? We now teach the dogs to do things like scent detection and agility and tri-ball and rally and doggy dance and other kinds of activities that then when we place the dog with the client, a disabled individual, they are taught how to use the dog in agility or scent detection or some of these other things only to do it as recreation so that then they take the dog that has these skills and they join maybe Noseworks, which is a recreational dog scent detection program and, part of the part of the social life of that group of people that are doing those activities. And so now we actually have added recreation to the, instead of just task skills, to the repertoire.
All right, I'm going to ask some things about Bergen College in a sec, but I want to bring a caller into the conversation while we can as well. Hi, you're on Talking Animal with Dr. Benita Bergen. So, Dr. Bergen, so an additional aspect reflecting your pioneering spirit, of course, beyond what we're talking about with service dogs and getting that launched and assisting people with mobility limitations, carry, and countless other sins, is that this creating a college specializing in training students in canine studies. Can you sort of just, I guess, maybe just briefly describe the major ways Bergen College of Canine Studies resembles a conventional university campus and the major way it differs from that?
The major way it is similar to it is we have courses that they take, and they have to be at the course time at 8 o'clock in the morning and go from class.
But are they all dog courses, or is there a broader?
Oh no, it's broad. I mean, they have to learn about disabilities and I mean, it's much broader than that. They have to learn about health, dog health, and caretaking and grooming and stuff like that. But the biggest difference is we assign every student a dog. So they actually, when they join the college, they are assigned a dog, and that dog stays with them 24/7.
For how long a period beyond the 24/7? Like, is it a year?
Their entire time
they're studying?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. Because that gives them, I mean, the kinds of insights you get living with a dog as well as training a dog is so much, the breadth is so much bigger. And by the way, speaking of some of the things that we've done, I just thought, there's just been so many things, but we teach dogs to read. And I thought that maybe that would be a interesting.
How do you do that? And how do you assess that they are reading? I mean, how do you verify that?
It's easy.
You assign them a book report, or?
No, the reading that they do is read in big black print the commands, like sit, and we show them the card, the flashcard, just like you would with kids, a flashcard that has the word SIT on it, and you just show it to them, and you teach them how a correlation, of course, between those black letters
and what they're doing.
They do not have a human language center,
right?
So anybody that's taught the dog to sit realizes that when they teach them to sit, they're usually teaching them from a stand to go into a sit posture.
Okay.
Usually you find that if they are lying down and you say sit, they do not sit up. They don't get back up into a sit posture.
So
because
you got to start up to get to sit, but you can't go from lying down to sit.
No, they don't define... They don't have the definition, a dictionary definition of what sit means.
Okay.
So they only have they can only make the correlation of the word sit, the sound, it's a sound to them. And then they go into that posture that sound has been taught to them, that the meaning of that sound has been taught to them.
Okay, I'm going to bring a caller in a moment, but so with the sound, how does that work with reading a flashcard that says sit?
So they also have a visual, and what we have is we would put in big black letters SIT, and then we would tell them the word sit and show them the card, and then eventually, and usually it only takes 3 or 4 times. If they know the command ahead of time, which of course we're anticipating, we then can just pull out the card and they'll look at the shape of the letters, just like they would look at the shape of something out in the, you know, nature. And they look at the shape of the letter and they go, oh yeah, I know what those shapes mean.
So one is saying sit in that scenario. They're just holding up the card and the dog sits.
Or turns or get something, you know, go get
moves in some way
something, yeah. Or you know,
to the card, obviously, in some regard.
Yeah, yeah. And we teach 112 commands to dogs.
Wow.
Just as a normal, you know, set of expectations, tasks, essentially.
Yeah.
And so each letter, each card that they have a, and I, as I said, I published a book on it. It's really exciting to see them, So you, as long as you're expecting them to actually look at the card, and you have to teach them to look at the card, so the card means something to them, then they will turn, they'll up, they'll go to bed, they'll whatever is on the card once you've taught it.
That's amazing. Yeah. All right, let's see if we still have our caller here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Benita Bergen.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead. It's you, sir.
Hi. Yeah, listen, I tell you, I love WMNF. I mean, especially for, you know, having, you know, the special person on to explain this. I mean, this is a great feel-good story about empathy and education. I mean, it's just, I mean, this kind of thing you really just love to project. I mean, so, you know, that's just a comment. I wanted to thank you both for informing all your listeners about this wonderful topic.
Well, that's a lovely comment. Thank you so much. Did you have a question for Dr. Bergen, or you just wanted to make that comment?
Well, is it a nonprofit that the doctor has?
Bergen College, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
The hardest thing to do in all of the work we're doing is fundraise. The actual work is fantastically exciting and interesting. Fundraising is a whole different ball of wax.
It is, yes. But, you know, I mean, you just got to keep at it. But, you know, the more you talk about your organization, I mean, wow. So it's...
Well, that's really kind of you.
To do something. Yeah, I'd like to read your book, so... but anyway, I appreciate the exposure. That's great.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in and for your nice comments.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. Take care.
Bye-bye. You too.
So, Dr. Bergen, back to the dogs. We're sort of, unfortunately, almost toward the end of our time, sadly. I feel like there's so many fascinating things I'd still love to explore with you. But when you talk about giving the student the dogs, are there specific breeds of dogs that you've determined over the years that work for this work and conversely do not?
The hunting breeds, the Golden Retrievers Lab, turn out to be more responsive to a partnership as opposed to going out and working independently on their own.
Mm-hmm.
We're also looking at doing things like breeding a small breed of dog to become placed in dentist offices. We put dogs in. We work with veterans a lot, and we're, you know, we have them train the dogs in the series of commands so that the dog would be placed with their fellow veteran, and it helps them get the therapy that training the dog provides them is just astounding. We have dogs working in schools with kids with autism. I think one of the things I want to see done next is to get every school, every elementary school around the country to have a class in dogs so that the kids learn young how what a sentient being this dog is and how real they are, so that they don't, when they grow up, throw them into an animal shelter or, you know, just get rid of them or put them on a screen outside but to really understand the dogs and have that value system that we have all, I think, that have been involved in this kind of work understand.
Well, and, that's great.
And I'm hoping we can get that done in the next couple of years.
That's fantastic. Well, anything else as we sort of wind up here? I'm sorry, we are nearing the end of our time, Dr. Bergen, here, but anything else along those lines, like the thing you just mentioned about class and dogs for kids? Anything else as you kind of got 50-plus years surveying the scene, doing this kind of work that you would like to see get done that you haven't quite had a chance to complete or just haven't had a chance to get to it on your to-do list?
Just more and more research.
All right, cool. Well, I'm going to try to take a quick call, which is probably Gillian and Liddy, since we're out of time just about, but let's try it anyways. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Benita Bergen.
Hi, this is Bill in Jacksonville, founding supporter of MNF. I love the show. I really appreciate you having Dr. Bergen on, and I'd like her to address an issue that there's really no standardization about, but it's very difficult to navigate. And I say that because I have a black lab and Great Dane mix, and she has been unbelievable. I lived on the streets in Pinellas County and then here in Jacksonville, and she came to me as a puppy. I didn't look for a dog, but I was literally living in the back of a truck that didn't run, and she came to me as a pup, and she and I have lived on the streets ever since, and she's been abducted 3 times. She's been returned, obviously. She's been on TV news and a local newspaper here. But my issue primarily is she is without a doubt a service animal. She goes everywhere that my 2 feet have gone in that period of time. And she does not get excited at anything. She does not chase birds. She doesn't chase cats. She doesn't get excited when people come up to pet her.
I'm so sorry. We're just about out of time. So if you have a final way to wrap it up.
The service animal vest requirement. Because some people will bring up, well, she doesn't wear a vest. Well, I don't want to advertise that, you know. But the rules regarding vests and what type of signage and cards, because it's all over the board. So if there were any kind of standardization, I'll let it go at that. And if you can address that, Dr. Bergen, great job. I love your program, and thank you, Duncan.
Thank you so much for your call. So a quick answer, 30 seconds or less, if you could, Dr. Bergen, about standardization.
Well, one of the things that I created, I can't even tell you how many years ago, was a group called Assistance Dogs International, which does set up a lot of rules, and it does accredit programs and does make sure that and people who have individually trained dogs can actually go get one of those programs to acknowledge their capabilities. You know, they probably would test the dog to make sure that it doesn't do anything inappropriate, and then they can usually get a credit for having a individual service dog.
Oh, great. All right. Well, Dr. Bergen, this has been fascinating. I really enjoyed speaking to you. We've been speaking with Dr. Bonita Bergen. It's Bergen College of Canine Studies, which you can find online at Bergen, BERGINU.EDU. And there's more we'll hopefully talk again and that we didn't get a chance to discuss today. But really enjoyed speaking to you and learned a lot. And thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals.
And thank you.
All right, so we're going to move into a slightly expanded version of the Comedy Corner of the Piece by rising comedy star Josh Johnson, regular anchor on The Daily Show. Selected for the conversation with Dr. Bergen that we just had in mind, here's Josh Johnson with a piece called Emotional Support Dogs, Sorry, versus Service Dogs in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I felt so, so dumb. I didn't realize a service dog and an emotional support dog were two different things. I knew they were different because the names are different, but I didn't realize in which ways they were different. A service dog is trained. That's a trained animal to take care of the person that has the need that they help with. An emotional support dog is just a dog you feel a connection to that you just get to emotionally support. The dog doesn't have a choice, really. The dog is... You just roll up on a dog one day and you're like, I'm going to tell you everything. That's, wow, I did not know. Had no idea. And I bring it up because my friend, she got an emotional support dog for her husband without knowing that this dog was an emotional wreck. Know what's wrong with the dog. They bring the dog home. Something wrong with the dog throat, okay? I don't know what it is, but it can't bark right. So it doesn't bark. It just scream, okay? And not like a yelp. This isn't sad. This is worse than that. It just screams human screams, okay? So the dog, I was on the phone with her, heard the dog in the background. The dog was like, oh! That's just all the time. That's all day what the dog does. Nonstop. It's crazy. The dog has bad nerves, and so it screams all the time. Everything sets it off. You pet the dog, it'll scream, and then it'll let you pet it, right? Because you snuck up on it to pet it. So you pet it, you're like, oh. It's terrible. Dog's a light sleeper, too. So the dog will be taking naps, the most Instagrammable naps you've ever seen. Just like belly up, paws down, everything. And it'll still be snoring little puppy snores, too, like, oh. That's how it wakes up every day. And so she's like, my life is hell. This is terrible because I got the dog as emotional support dog for my husband, not knowing that the dog is anxious and my husband's anxious. So the dog is emotionally supporting the husband, just in the wrong direction. You know what I mean? Because then the husband is like, I don't feel so good. And the dog's like, yeah, you're right. It's a lot to be worried about, dog. It's crazy out here. What's that over there? That's what it's doing all the time. She can't get any sleep because the dog sleeps with them. So the dog sleeps in between. It's actually adorable. It's like very like home living. Her right here, dog over here, husband over here. But they live in like a noisy apartment, paper thin walls. So you can hear the door slam from down the hall, right? And so the dog waking up all night. So somebody will slam the door down the hall, a door that has nothing to do with them, that is none of their business. And the dog will be like, oh! And then her husband will be like, oh! And then she will be like, ah! That's just all day. That's just going and revolving, this domino effect of screams. It got so bad, someone called the police. Police show up to her door, knock. She answers, like, hey, I'm here to do, like, a wellness check. Neighbor said that they heard screaming. And she's like, oh, no, I'm fine. I'm okay and everything. And my husband's here. Come over. He comes over to the door. He's like, hey, I'm good. We're all good in here. And the cop is like, oh, okay, cool. Where's that third person? Because they said specifically that there was three people. And then she's like, no, it's just us here. So now they look like they've murdered a person. Like, now it looks like a cover-up, right? And it's like, no, it's just here. Cop's writing down everything that they're saying. As the cop is writing, he dropped his pen, and the dog in the background is like, oh! And the cop sees the dog, and is like, was that? And then she's like, oh, yeah, that must have been what it was. I got the dog for my husband, but it turns out that the dog is anxious, and my husband is anxious. My life is hell. I can't...
All right, that was Josh Johnson. Today's Comedy Corner extended version. It's emotional support dog versus service dog, taken from his album Live From Before. He's talking animals on WMNF Tampa. And coming up on the WMNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WMNF's brief news recap. Then we shift back to music programming with Sam Vall holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C hosting the Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m. And then more good music after that, of course, on 88.5 WNF from there. So we just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. We'll return next Wednesday with another edition, of course, right here at 11 a.m. on 88.5. And I invite you to visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. Apple Podcasts and other podcast platforms are there as well. Also links to our social media pages. You can also subscribe to our newsletter. Find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Wikiwachi, and beyond. Thanks again for all your support in the recently completed fun drive. We just wrapped it up earlier this morning, so thanks for your support of Talking Animals and all the shows on the station overall. Really appreciate it. See you right back here next week at 11 a.m. on 88.5 WMNF Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, of course. Stay tuned for The Conversation.